let's start the show.
For Thursday, March 12th, 2020, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Feels like it's been so long.
Too long.
Way too long, for sure, since we've been in this podcast room all together. And it has, because the era of the Duocast, well, is on hiatus, at least for this week. We're back at full capacity. I'm Norm, joined here by Jeremy Williams.
Hi, Norm.
Hi, Jeremy. And Kishore Hari.
Hello.
We're all in studio, not working from home. Well, most of us working from home. We actually haven't even been in our office for almost a week. I think the last time was when we recorded this podcast last. But how are you guys doing? How are you all feeling?
Wow, that can't be, because the recording equipment was changed.
Oh, you know, we were here on Thursday.
Yeah.
We were here, yes, for 10th anniversaries.
I'm doing okay. I'm just glad to have Kishore back here. I missed you.
I'm not glad I'm back. I don't know about you. I'm hanging in there. Like a lot of people, there's a lot of concern in the air. I'm actually trying to take...
Maybe your concern would be a little less if you didn't have like global thermonuclear war on your screen right now.
No, I just have the Johns Hopkins map of coronavirus
which
cases.
Looks like something from War Games, I might add.
Yeah, I mean, they could have chosen a different color scheme.
Right. Red.
I'm actually trying to use the work from home time constructively. So I've been, every day, we've been going to a different SF landmark. And because people aren't out about as much, and social distancing doesn't mean you can't, like, go outside and, like, and be in public places. You just don't want to gather with a lot of people. And so we were at Twin Peaks at sunset yesterday. It was awesome.
Beautiful. Very nice warm day.
Went on the bridge the other day. Oh. So I think it's an awesome time to sort of be a tourist in my own town.
The moon last night was spectacular.
Yeah, absolutely.
Last two nights, yeah, full moon, very close to it. We've been doing almost the exact same thing. We found that self-isolating with a 15-month-old
and a
dog is very difficult. So we've been going on drives in the early evenings and afternoons, because we feel like at least in the car, the baby can look outside and we can show him parts of the city, and there are nice routes to go around and stop. And, you know, we'll look at the buffalo because we have the bison in Golden Gate Park. There's some nice hidden pathways, Stowe Lake. Yeah, lots of fun places.
Now, let's hold up. If there's one beneficiary in this world, and all credit to the Twitter user who made this joke first, it is the dogs of the world who all of a sudden have their humans home all day long.
Yeah.
Dogs are winning this entire experience.
And helping.
Ripley
They're
must
comforting.
Be
yes.
Heaven.
Yeah.
Does your child fall asleep in the car? That used to be a strategy.
No.
No luck there.
Actually, we don't prefer him sleep in the car.
Oh.
If he's only going to get one nap a day, and we want that nap to be 2 hours and 15 minutes,
yeah,
then we would prefer not be in the car, because then you lose that long nap.
Mm.
Yeah, but he's pretty good in the car. Got some boba, got some, you know, little snacks, and he's just munching around and you know, going around town. He's not drinking the boba. We're drinking the boba.
I thought you were giving the child boba tea.
No. We're taking the boba tea. He gets
he's 15 months. He can handle the caffeine. No problem.
He gets a little sippy cup. Yeah, but we know there's a lot going on, not only in the world, but the United States as well. And while we will be trying to give some updates, things that we've read and people that we follow who we trust, we also want this podcast to maybe give a little bit of a distraction. Or if you're at home, then, you know, there's still some fun things to look forward to. We'll be covering, of course, lots of the event cancellation and stuff. And I guess that does take us to... Wait. Kishore has one more thing to say.
No, I want to ask one thing. So my kid at his school, they... basically don't do handshakes anymore because of what's happening.
Mm.
And so they've been doing like elbow bumps, yep, and then Jeremy, you were telling us that at your kid's school they're doing foot bumps.
Foot bumps.
I think
what is a foot bump?
Uninspired.
What do you mean? Is that, what should it be?
Well, I think Norm had the right idea. I think we go full Vulcan salute here.
It wasn't my idea. CNET had the article. I just shared it. But yes, Vulcan salute.
I mean, it's appropriate for the time. Live long and prosper.
That's right.
Saying that to people, but also saying it from a distance.
You're going to out and spotlight the people who can't do it.
It's about the effort. It's not about the actual formation.
Is that a
Spock, new Spock, Zachary Quinto himself could not do it.
I know.
That's okay. You can still a raised hand.
Ah,
it would still work.
Your best effort.
Your best. Yeah. Okay. The lesser known second Vulcan salute is your best effort.
I'm going to try this today and report back.
Okay.
I think it's not going to go well for me.
I think. What if the head nod? The classic. Sup? Head nod.
No. Let's not bring that up.
I think in your crowd, I'm just guessing that the Vulcan salute would go over well.
Oh, Jeremy's outing me as a nerd. Oh no.
Top story this week.
Now, I was also going to say, I was going to try to do the entire podcast without touching my face. And as you press the button, I touch my
face. It's not possible.
It's not possible.
Not possible.
It is so difficult. And the elbow to elbow greeting, you know, we did that at PAX 2011. Mm-hmm. Remember when Gary did that? That's the whole thing. What it is. Yeah. Elbow to elbow. Make the X.
What? He said what it is?
Yeah. That was the greeting.
Oh.
That was the.
I do not like that. I do not care for that, Gary.
Boom. Okay. Top story. Following up on last week's events that have been canceled, there are now major ones in the coming months, and even further out that have been postponed. So we talked about GDC, of course, was canceled last week. Google I/O. Now, just after we recorded a podcast last week, South by Southwest was shut down by the city of Austin. It's a big deal because it's not about a rescheduling of this event. It was going to bring in, you know, a third of a billion dollars to the city. And it affects just so many people, not only the small businesses, but also the artists who are going to go there and connect with other people and share their works.
Yeah, the people that work in restaurants, the people that, you know, rent out their homes, all of that kind of stuff. South by Southwest was pretty salty in their response. They're like, this was out of our hands. The city decided and weren't really, they didn't seem on board with the decision. I thought that was pretty clear from their message.
Yeah, the CEO of South by Southwest, the organization, says that the company stands to lose tens of millions of dollars from not running it this year. They had to let go about 50 employees, which really, really sucks. And so, you know, while the whole insurance thing is still, I think, up in the air as to whether people and businesses can get covered, but some companies are starting like little fundraisers or trying to run virtual events, and we implore people, anyone who is interested in, you know, the technology, the music, and kind of the arts that were celebrated at South by Southwest to reach out and find those people and support them.
Yeah, Adam was actually going to talk with Joe DeRisi again at South by Southwest. And since Joe, for those that listen to that, still entitled, he was one of the first scientists to characterize SARS, and he happens to be an infectious disease expert in coronaviruses, particularly ones that are incubated in that come from bat reservoirs. So I'm hoping to get that conversation back online another time soon, virtually, because I think it's kind of an important one right now.
Yeah. Emerald City Comic Con delayed. That's in Washington, Seattle. And E3 is the latest big event to be canceled. The ESA reported this morning, and it was widely reported yesterday, that it wouldn't be happening, and confirmed E3, which is scheduled for June. That was not going to be next month. That was, you know, a few months out there. That has officially now been canceled.
Canceled.
Does that seem too far to you? Like, it's all the way in June.
No, I mean, the two big ones that now at least we're looking toward and probably will be canceled are WWDC, and Apple has not made that announcement yet. That would be also later in the summer.
That's when they can go virtual on for at least the keynote.
Yeah, absolutely. If they're going to make product announcements and things to show developers, what you lose are, again, the meetings and the Facebook.
Which are important, don't get me wrong.
Totally, right? Totally. But sessions that they would have run, they could all have done, they could do that virtually. Same as GDC. And then San Diego Comic-Con is, well, that's the big one, right? That's not only hundreds of thousands of people,
another
but
money
also
maker.
A big business hit for the city of San Diego. There's no announcement there, but all signs point to a decision for that being announced.
When is that usually held?
That's in late July.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's even further out, right in the heart of summer. So that's the cancel news update.
Well, Coachella get canceled.
Oh, that's right, Coachella postponed. Yeah, so pushed to October, I believe, and that was going to be two weekends of, again, hundreds of thousands of people gathering in, well.
I think the next domino to fall are going to be sports, and we've already seen that with, like, some college basketball stuff, but I think March Madness is going to probably be played in empty stadiums, and I think the NBA and NHL are going to make that decision really, really soon.
The leagues have already provided guidance. If they need to, they would just play the games in empty arenas, but it's about whether the owners, I guess.
There's a lot of money at stake, yeah. And I think that's why they're pushing back, but now's when it can be of most benefit.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else to say in terms of the updates for events? I know we're going to talk more about this in
I just want to say science. That, like, I very much understand how there's a lot of people that feel like this is a overreaction and how much this sucks and how much this hurts people. That's just the way it feels. And it's really hard to understand, but I think all of these people aren't making these decisions lightly. I think they're really, like, they're losing a ton of money by doing this too. So if they're making that decision, I think it's a sign of how serious things are behind the scenes and the kind of advice they're getting.
It's almost a, I don't know if it's a catch-22, but it seems odd because those people, you know, they might feel vindicated if there isn't an outbreak because we take these steps. And that's frustrating because you don't want to have to, you know, deal with an outbreak because you didn't take these steps. So I hope that we have no outbreak.
There's not going to be any clean kind of endpoint in the look back here. Yeah. It's not going to be like we did the right thing kind of moment, you know, 6 months from now as we're looking back on where we were.
Do preppers want, like, and no one wants this to happen, I guess, but do people who stock up and prepare, maybe not just for this type of event, but for other type of societal, you know, haltings, do they feel like they are frustrated if they can't exercise what they've prepared for? Right? If you stockpiled and there's an expiration date on that stuff you've stockpiled, do you feel like it's gone to waste?
Right. Yes, that's a good question. I imagine that it has, you might feel like you were prepared anyway. And is
that enough? Maybe. Is that personally satisfying, or does the satisfaction and the vindication come from being relatively more prepared than your neighbor?
I don't imagine that being in that frame of mind really comes with any form of satisfaction. I think that you
probably... Well, that's a very mindful and zen way of thinking about it. I completely agree. I don't think some people want to see the world burn, but, I mean, the deeper and more invested you could get to prepping,
yeah.
You see those stories of Costco's being swarmed and all manner of things being sold out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like if you don't have to end up using that stuff, that it was not worth it?
Well, you do end up using it, right? I mean, eventually,
hopefully,
you use your stores of TP and your all of the
yes,
canned goods
yes.
that you buy.
You know what I feel vindicated about? The bidet recommendation in my favorite things at the end of last year. I have really come out of that shining.
Well, parts of you, for sure.
Well done, Kishore.
All right. Oh, we're going to turn to some matters of a lighter heart. This is going to be a very eclectic pop culture news section. There's no order in which we're really talking about this. But let's just go down our list, because this is what we put in our show notes. First off, DC Comics. Do you remember A Death in the Family? This is more of a story for Kishore and me, Jeremy.
It's one of the most iconic Batman books and visuals, like panels from Batman, that ever existed.
Let's set the stage for Jeremy. The year is 1988.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Right. Comics were the boom times. This is right before the kind of Marvel Comics in the early 90s trying to re-release all the number ones. Comics were very successful. People were collecting them. People were reading them. They were a mainstream part of entertainment. And in DC Comics, Batman, still probably next to Superman, their most successful, most popular character.
This is right around the time his film came out, right? In 89?
89, yeah. Right? So this is like, we're talking about peak Batman.
Yeah.
There was a story arc that shook the Bat universe. And that was the death of Robin, mm-hmm. of Jason Todd.
This
Jason
is Robin Todd number, is
number two. Right. So Robin number one, Dick Grayson. He's the one, the circus orphan. Right. When you think of Batman and Robin,
yep.
most people think of Dick Grayson. He was the Flying Graysons. Yep. His parents were killed in one of the many storytellings. The mob killed his parents, took away the net. Batman was at the, Bruce Wayne was at the circus. He then adopted the kid to be his ward and raised him to be his sidekick, the plucky sidekick.
If your parents aren't killed in some tragic way, you can't be part of the Batman universe. You realize this, right?
Yeah, now I do.
Yeah. You know, but Batman, Robin, both orphans. Yeah. And then also, it was really wish fulfillment for the readers, for the kids reading the Batman comics back in the Silver Age and the Golden Age. You know, they wanted the kids, the publishers wanted to give kids reading comic books and Avatar so they could project themselves into the worlds of the comic. And so Robin was, and all the other teenage sidekicks, Superboy, Donna Troy and all these kids, Teen Titans, right? They were all basically ways for kids to project themselves into this universe. Well, Dick Grayson grew up, he became Nightwing, had a falling out with Batman, and Batman needed a Robin. And so, true to the song, Batmobile lost its wheels, and that's because a kid who lived in the streets by the name of Jason Todd was old enough to steal the Batmobile's wheels. Batman caught him in the act and said, "Kid, I like your moxie. Mm-hmm. Would you like to be my next Robin?" It was a little more, involved than that. But basically, he found a kid in the streets, trained him to be a new Robin. This Robin was a little bit more rebellious, a little bit more brutal. He was very divisive amongst the fans. He definitely was not the shiny goody two shoes that Dick Grayson was. And he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder because he wasn't the first Robin. Some fans liked him. Some fans really did not like him.
How did you feel about him?
I was 4 years old at the time. I didn't really have thoughts on Batman and or Robin.
I participated in what you're about to talk about.
So in 1988, DC had a miniseries, four-issue storyline where Jason Todd never knew who his parents were, right? He was just found in the street. And so he goes on a quest to find his parents and to find his mother, at least. And he followed these clues using his detective skills. And at one point, he thinks that his mother is Talia. Is it Talia al Ghul? No. It's not Talia al Ghul. It's what's her name? Lady Shiva. He thinks his mother is Lady Shiva. So other like these like big characters and rogues in the Batman universe. But he finds his mother and she actually betrays him and is working with the Joker, and the Joker ties him up and brutally beats him with a crowbar.
Comic books are dark.
It's a dark time for comic books.
There's a DC animated movie called Under the Red Hood. where this, you can see the crowbar scene.
Oh my God. It's brutal, right?
It is brutal and it's unflinching and, but it is the Joker as the Joker is. He is not beating Robin to beat Robin. He's beating Robin to hurt Batman.
Yeah. And not only does he tie Robin up and beat him, but he blows him up on this train. He literally sets like dynamite and the train explodes. And at the end of issue 3, Batman finds Jason Todd. And so readers, you're like, oh my God, this like this thing's this. I cannot believe this is happening to an actual superhero. And at the last page of that comic book, something interesting shows up.
Is this where the levity comes in?
No, there's no levity.
No. Oh,
I thought we were transitioning from coronavirus to something lighter.
Oh, no.
Okay.
So there's basically an advertisement. You have this big splash page and it's Batman holding Robin. Right? You might want to put this image up.
It's not up.
No, it's similar to that image, but it says in big text, Robin will die because of the Joker. Because the Joker wants revenge. But you can prevent it with a telephone call. And there are two 1-900 numbers that are put on the page.
Oh, this is like the Dark Knight on the ships where they have to...
Oh, wow. Okay. I've never made that connection.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Except we got to vote. In the movie, it was decided.
Chris Nolan's Dark Knight to a whole new level.
Thank you. I thought I'd contribute somewhere.
Oh, whoa. Mind blown. That's a meta commentary on the audience. Interesting. So, 1-1900 number. And for those of you who don't know, a 1-900 number was in the 80s and 90s, a number you could dial that would charge your phone line per minute or a fee based on just making the call. It was pay to make the phone call. One number, the Joker fails, Robin lives. The other number, the Joker succeeds and Robin will not survive. Only works in US and Canada, and they would these phone numbers would work but on 2 days.
Wait a minute. So this, you're actually saying readers got to do this.
Yes. Readers got the comic.
Wow.
Bought it off the newsstands because you'd been waiting for it. Yeah. And then on September 15th and 16th, 1988, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern, you could make a phone call and get charged 50 cents.
Yeah, nothing.
On that phone call. 50 cents. Excuse me.
Hey.
Issues themselves were like, 50 cents, 75 cents. It was like basically having to buy another comic book.
I feel like they were already about a dollar at that point. Jeremy, I'll have you know, I didn't just read this book. I voted.
I believe it.
And I got in trouble when the phone bill came.
Did you vote more than once?
No, I only voted once.
Okay.
50 cents popped up here.
What is this?
Yeah. Why are you dialing 1-900 numbers? Are you making naughty phone calls? I want Robin to live.
You think I voted for Robin to live?
You voted for
him
to die?
He's a Thanos
I killed Robin.
So I'm going
to... Snapped his fingers.
I'll give you what happened, and then I'll let you guess, okay? Well, first of all, how many people do you think called?
Doesn't it go the other way?
Yeah, how many people do you think called?
Oh, I think probably 5,000 people called.
5,000 for about each of the lines. About 10,000 people called.
Wow. You can't say people. You mean 10,000 calls.
10,000 calls were made. Right. And there are rumors that people developed like systems to dial the numbers. And you know, I would spend $20 to make my voice heard make repeat dial. Voter fraud, essentially. Right? So about 10,000 people called. Robin died.
I'm surprised by that one.
Do you know how many votes were the deciding factor?
One.
It was not one. That would be amazing if Kishore was the swing vote there.
It was the right call.
72 votes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had no idea it was that close.
It was super, super close. And 10,614 total calls. It cost the readers about $5,000 total, which is $1,988. Not so bad, right?
Okay.
And a margin of 72 votes. The writer, the publishers, and it was written by Jim Starlin, who, as Kishore will tell you, is
the father of Thanos.
The creator of Thanos.
There it is.
So a dark idea indeed, right? And under the stewardship of Denny O'Neill and the publishers of DC Comics. But the writers, right, if they were falling, because they could dial from their own end, they could dial the telephone service, like a back channel number, and get the tally.
Okay, yeah, right? That makes sense. Yeah.
And they could get a tally and get updated real time. They had to prepare two versions of an ending.
They did?
Of course they did.
But they didn't, I mean, couldn't they wait till the votes came in?
They had to send the issue.
Oh my gosh.
Next issue out.
Yeesh.
Right? And, you know, if you've read the story, it's a Death in the Family, four-issue series, the Joker gets away with it.
Yeah.
Joker, Batman tries Robin dies, Batman's furious, Joker gets out of it by getting diplomatic immunity by becoming an ambassador for a Middle Eastern country, going to the UN, and Batman about to kill the Joker, Superman comes in and stops Batman because of the rule of law. And stops Batman from exacting vengeance.
It was prophesized in that incredible fable, you know, Batmobile lost a wheel, Joker got away.
Got away.
I mean, it was just a known thing that had to happen.
That's actually where that song comes from?
No.
No, okay. It just happens to coincide. But the news is Polygon has this wonderful story, this feature describing the events and what happened behind the scenes leading up to this kind of first like public voting system for the fans. And the writer went to the DC archives and got to look at the pages of the alternate reality, the what would have happened if the readers had voted Robin to survive.
So bad.
And they showed for the first time
awful.
The pages of Batman finding Robin and saying, "He's alive."
It looks
God. It's pretty bad.
So that moment where Superman saves the Joker, that's a little Civil War too, isn't it?
It's definitely a little bit.
Tony Stark as Superman standing up for the rule of law and Captain America as Batman.
There's definitely some division.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
But no character stays dead forever. Jason Todd did come back thanks to the Lazarus Pit and became the Red Hood. A brutal vigilante. He's actually a fan favorite character in the Batman universe. He's
been in multiple Batman video games.
That's
too.
Right. That's right. He took off his Red Hood mask to reveal yet another mask. Yeah. And the Red Hood is a callback to the original namesake of the Joker, the original moniker that he took on before he became the Joker. So Death in the Family wanted to have
all
a little
these
bit of
years,
history lesson.
You feel like you made the right choice.
Oh, no doubt.
That's got to be
Jason Todd is the worst.
Vindicating.
Yeah. Maybe less vindicating is the release of the Rise of Skywalker novelization coming out this month with some revelations within. I know we all have different varying thoughts about the plotting of the Rise of Skywalker. Have you guys read this? What were in the headlines?
No.
A little bit of a spoiler, perhaps, but apparently the book's still well worth reading. But one of the reveals that happens is that Palpatine's son, because one of the things that fans tried to figure out is how could Palpatine have had a son? When was he married? You know, how old was Palpatine when he became the emperor? And it turns out his son was just a clone, a failed Palpatine clone. And not only that, but the Palpatine that we saw on screen himself, also a clone. But the one true clone, Kylo Ren, sensed that Palpatine had the spirit of the Emperor had the spirit of Palpatine.
Wow, so the Emperor really did die.
The Emperor really did die.
So who cloned him?
I guess those zealots on that planet.
Oh, wow.
Big multinational cloning company on Exegol.
And then built those ships as well.
Wow.
Yeah. The Battle of Exegol was the big finale, of course, of the Skywalker saga, the big battle. And there's the DVD, Blu-ray, digital release coming out later this month. And so we're seeing some of the special features from that. And one of the special features are interviews with ILM visual effects artists talking about the design of that massive fleet that came in, that Lando brought to the battle. And one, do you have any idea how many ships were in that fleet?
God, I mean, just like thinking back to the scene, I was like, oh, 150?
It was thousands. Thousands of ships. And it was a huge effects challenge. And apparently they exhausted the ship designs that they had. Every ship design that had been in the Star Wars universe, from Star Tours to Clone Wars to Rebels to Resistance, every ship they threw on screen in some capacity. Old designs for B-Wings, things based on Ralph McQuarrie art. But they still had to come up with dozens of new ship designs. Mm-hmm. So that was a fun artistic challenge for them. And the special feature, which IO9 has a clip of, actually runs through a slideshow of all of those new ships that are created. And it's a fun little thing just to watch.
Okay. So, I like spaceships.
Yeah, yeah. Even the U-Wing from Rogue One made an appearance.
Lots of Easter eggs for fans.
Lots and lots of Easter eggs. I like the fact that the Star Tours ship is there as well.
What is the Star Tours ship? Like the external? When do you see the Star Tours ship?
When you're in the Star Tours line, you see the ship. Yeah. It looks like a bus.
Right.
Right. There's actually a name for it. And it's canon because, you know, the new Star Tours ride that they updated for Rise of Skywalker takes you into that battle itself.
Oh, wow.
You get to see from that perspective. It's the, what's the name? What's the name of this ship?
Oh. The Star Tours bus.
No, is this Star Speeder 1000? Maybe?
Okay. It's not important.
No, but it's you know, it basically looks like the motion control vehicle.
That's funny.
Yeah. Also, tangential related to Star Wars news, we had a death in cinema. Mark Max Van Sydow passed away at the age of 90. He, in the Star Wars universe, appeared once in Force Awakens. He was in the very first scene that you saw, actually, in The Force Awakens, chatting with Poe. But of course,
to Poe.
Yeah, he gives the map.
Yeah.
And he has that great line about Princess Leia. She'll always be royalty to him. For him, she'll always be royalty.
Yeah, good memory.
And, of course, known in cinema, oh my God, for so many roles.
So many.
The Exorcist.
He was in so many bad movies, too, but he was great in them, like Flash Gordon.
He was Ming the Merciless.
Yes.
That's crazy.
I got to rewatch that.
How could someone be both Ming the Merciless and yet also the priest from Exorcist?
The powers of Christ compel you.
Incredible. Yep. What a career. And all Game of Thrones, he was the Three-Eyed Raven, his presence will be missed. Definitely a titan and icon in cinema history.
May we all make it to 90.
Yeah, at least, the very least. I want to make it to 2099. See the next millennia. Or no, it's not the next millennia. Next century, at least. Okay, movie news, two bits of...
By the way, apparently last week on the podcast, I may have said something to the effect of when Michael Jackson comes back to basketball. And
Michael Jordan?
I said, apparently.
I must have not been listening.
It is.
I already didn't register.
I have been accused on Twitter of saying Michael Jackson. Now, obviously, we can't prove this.
No, there's no record.
No way.
No record.
But why wouldn't you correct me?
It must have been a slip of the mind
Got the Jordan.
I understood what you were going for.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just wondering if you would like let me slide. Have that one.
Yeah, I'm sure plenty of things I've let slide and vice versa on this podcast. Yeah. Black Widow, the final trailer is out, focusing on the villain of the movie Taskmaster.
Yes.
Okay, so a little bit of context for you. This is a prequel to the Infinity Saga. It happens between Civil War. At the end of Civil War, you remember all the secrets come out. Black Widow says, you know, all the ledger is all out there. And then you don't see her until Infinity War with Captain America when she has the dyed blonde hair. And this movie happens between then, what she's doing between them, going back to her roots in the Black Widow program and her family, the family that we never knew about. And then the villain is Taskmaster, which in the comic books is a guy who has a skull as a face and then also wears a hood. And his power is that he can look at any fighting style and watch videos of any fighting style and then replicate that fighting style. So you see in the trailer where he emulates the fighting style of Captain America, of Hawkeye, of Black Panther, and of Black Widow herself. Formidable.
Huh. Yeah. I like the name Taskmaster. It's a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a commonly used name, both in DC and Marvel. I will say what I liked most about this wasn't actually the Taskmaster, but the interplay between the sort of allies in this of Black Widow. They seem to have like some
her family
fun repartee. Yeah.
Is that her
family.
What you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I didn't like that as much. Like I'm worried that maybe this isn't going to be a great movie.
I want it to be a little silly and fun at points.
I'm worried that the Russian accents are going to get to me.
They're
David
probably
Harbour's
gonna
terrible
be
Russian
yeah,
accent.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
At least we're all on the same
He's
page.
Over the top. The movie comes out April 24th, and so far not pushed back. So,
what do you hope from a stinger from this movie?
Oh, I haven't even thought about that. I'm just hoping this movie will be good. It's we're getting two Marvel movies this year, Black Widow and Eternals. And both of them are kind of, I mean, Black Widow is going to do well because we want to see more Black Widow. I don't know. I have no idea. Maybe it'll be Eternals thing. There's a big,
I just hope it's closure for her character.
Didn't the Stingers used to allude to Thanos and where the whole
right.
thing was headed?
So I don't want them to start something from this movie.
Aren't we going to see something about that?
This doesn't make sense. This movie, which is a prequel, yeah, and that character dies, okay, like doesn't make sense to set up like something like that.
I agree about the closure. I hope the Stinger isn't a way for them to leave the door open for her to come back in some magical way.
Yeah.
They have the ability to rewrite whatever history they want.
But it's comic books. You can do whatever you want.
Let the death be meaningful.
Let the audience decide.
Spoiler alert for Endgame.
If they put out 900 number up, I'm all yeah. in. I'm oh making God. As many phone calls as I can. Do it, Marvel.
What's the equivalent of that today? Having to pay, having to commit to make your voice heard. It's not a Twitter poll.
I think having to pay is a problem nowadays. Like people will just like you'll get whales that just, you know,
what about
control the
time
vote?
As opposed to money? You have to write an essay.
And then you got geeks who know how to make computers do it.
Oh, write an essay?
Yeah, I've read an essay.
Right?
And then you got to read them.
Well, make a video. You got to make a thoughtful video.
AI to read them.
Peter Jackson is working on a new documentary, which now has a release date. It's going to be released by Disney. It's a Beatles documentary with footage from the recording of Abbey Road, I want to say.
Awesome.
Let It Be. Oh, no. Yeah, Let It Be. It's recording sessions from the Beatles' Let It Be, including their final live concert as a group and their rooftop performance on Savile Row.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So this is, it's going to be unseen footage interesting that Peter Jackson and his production company is putting it together. I mean, the last thing he put out was They Shall Not Grow Old, which is an amazing documentary. And I'm interested what his take will be.
I'm interested to see how they apply the computer learning special effects to update the footage.
Do they need that?
I imagine they do.
For this footage?
I think you probably will take it for granted unless you see the making of.
If they do it the way like Apollo 11 did last year, where they kind of, they just cleaned up the images.
Sure, cleaning up the images, but in terms of like frame rate, like if something was shot, you know, 8mm,
yeah,
low frame rate, do you want to see that smoothed out?
I don't know.
The motion smoothed out.
I think Peter would do it.
I don't want them to mess with the audio, though.
Oh, no. The audio is going
to
be...
I don't know.
Held a high standard.
Have you listened to like the remaster of Sgt. Pepper's? It's like it's amazing. You hear things you didn't hear before. I mean, because they can do that now.
But that's not messing with the audio. That's just...
Isn't it?
I don't know.
It depends what you mean by that. It's
a remix.
Rooftop.
They went back to the source.
That rooftop concert's iconic, though.
Yes.
Like, are you going to mess with the audio from that?
No more iconic than Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And then there's Love, which I haven't seen, but apparently that's an amazing mix of Beatles music.
And that's going to be mixed for Dolby or mixed for the theatrical experience. Like, I would be happy for them to quote unquote mess with it if the mix makes you feel like you are there and feel that energy.
That's different, though, than messing with the audio tracks of them singing.
They're not going to auto-tune.
No.
I don't think you have to worry about that. That would be messing.
We all agree that would be crossing the line.
Yeah, that would be a line not to be crossed. Okay, a little bit more Marvel news. Now, there are two bits of Thor news. They're very exciting. One, I believe it was Tessa Thompson who confirmed that Christian Bale is going to be in the film.
Batman is in the Thor universe. Confirmed.
Yeah.
The prevailing theory, as Kishore and I discussed previously, was Beta Ray Bill. I think that's weird. Would you want to see Christian? Would Christian Bale want to be a CG character the way that Korg and
I thought
and
she
Rocket
confirmed
is.
Christian Bale as the villain of the movie.
That's correct.
Right?
Right.
Which so would not make sense if it's Beta Ray Bill.
Beta Ray Bill could be a villain written in this movie and then turned, you know, anti-hero slash hero.
I actually hope not. I hope it's some other, you know, god character from one of the realms.
Do you think he'll it's Taika Waititi, so you think he's going to take it seriously, Christian Bale, or is he going to be comedic Christian Bale? What is comedic Christian Bale?
Little Women Christian Bale? I don't know what comedic. Well,
no, he wasn't Little Women.
Yeah, he was in 1994.
Oh, okay.
Deep cut.
Yeah, that is deep cut.
He'll always be Laurie to me. I think this should play as a rom-com. It's Thor Love and Thunder.
So he's the over-the-top, the other suitor for Jane, new Thor. Interesting. The other big news from Thor is that the Guardians of the Galaxy are going to appear in some capacity.
Ooh, as Guardians of the Galaxy?
As the Guardians of the Galaxy. This will be the first time appearing ahead of their next film.
Are they all still alive?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
What's happened?
They were all... Yeah,
I know. Oh, this is you like have the clarity in your mind. I not always have the clarity.
No. There's only a couple characters that died.
We have a whiteboard, a pin board with all the headshots and big X's around.
There's only two characters that died.
Really?
Iron Man and Black Widow, not counting villains.
It's a fair question because of the Gamora question.
Oh, she's but she's alive.
Yeah. Okay, and more Taika Waititi news. Netflix announced that he's going to be taking on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for Netflix.
Animated series.
That's the big caveat.
Well, yeah, but he is producing, writing, and directing.
How is he this prolific? His name is attached to everything.
Will he be Willy Wonka?
He must.
He plays a role in all his films.
He must.
No, but he'll do some smaller part. He's never the main role. He's always some side character.
I mean,
character.
Look at Jojo Rabbit. He's basically one of the main roles. He's the...
Yeah, that's true.
It's only voicing.
Mm.
I don't know.
It would be amazing.
I just would love him as all of the Oompa Loompas.
That's good. Okay, great. Yeah. I hope that there are Oompa Loompas.
They're how is he not going to have Oompa Loompas in there? What's the point of doing this movie? Okay.
I never saw the Johnny Depp one. Were there Oompa Loompas?
There were Oompa Loompas in that, and that was one actor who was doubled up and played all the Oompa Loompas.
There you go.
And you've seen the musical and how they did the Oompa Loompas there.
I guess I did see the musical.
Yeah.
That was great. Yeah.
They puppeted them, essentially. This is going to be a series? As opposed to a movie, basically a two-part series. The question also for Willy Wonka and Roald Dahl fans is this just going to be Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? Mm-hmm. Or is this also going to be The Great Glass Elevator?
Right, the sequel.
The sequel, which is much less beloved. Still interesting art, but as a story, not very good as a follow-up.
Okay, well, that is a question.
Yeah. You know, I played a role in my elementary school production of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Norm, you and I have something in common. I too played a role.
What? Wait. I played one of the kids.
Okay, yeah, so did I.
I played Mike TV.
Oh, wow. You'd be great at Mike TV. God, you're like typecast for Mike TV.
I know.
That's great.
Yeah.
Pop culture. I was Charlie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Cheer up, Charlie. No.
Do you still have your golden ticket somewhere?
Oh, we didn't have enough money for a golden ticket. And
wait, you didn't play anything?
No, I was not in this way.
Oh, okay.
I was too busy voting in comic book.
Two more pieces of pop culture news. HBO announced that they have optioned, this is really amazing news, The Last of Us as a limited series event. Last of Us being the Naughty Dog video game, of course. Neil Druckmann is going to actually write part of it, and it's going to be co-written and showrun by Craig Mazin,
who did
Chernobyl.
Oh my God.
Oh my God, right?
Wow. Yeah.
And of the Script Notes podcast.
Crazy.
Very prolific writer, long run, but very successful recently of late, of course, with Chernobyl.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to watch this show. It's going to be so freaking intense.
This is done so much to assuage my fears of HBO diluting their quality with the formation of HBO Max. If they're doing shows like The Last of Us with those people behind Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm.
Very looking forward to this. HBO, of course, Westworld Season 3 is out this weekend. I have still not seen any of the new trailers, so I'm going to it completely cold and very excited, and maybe we'll talk about that in the weeks to come. Last bit of pop culture news, Neil Gaiman announced that Sandman is getting revived as an Audible drama. This is super interesting, and he will be doing the narration.
You mean like audible.com?
Yes.
Yep.
Basically.
Isn't there a Sandman series in the works still? No?
There was a movie in the works for the longest time. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt was attached to it. I don't know what the state of that is right now. But
this probably means that's not going forward soon, because they wouldn't release these two things contemporaneously.
Well, the rights, I mean, I think they can live, they can coexist. You can have, you know, you can have American Gods as the Audible drama as well, and live alongside the Showtime series. I hope that people, if they want to consume Sandman in this format, will still go back and read the graphic novels, because the art by Kelly Jones is so good in Sandman. And there's so many issues.
The only person in my life who was a comic book fan before you two was my college roommate, David Gaddis, who went on to actually write a comic. His favorite comic in the world was Sandman.
Yeah.
That's all I know about it.
It's fantastic. It is. There are a lot of deep cuts. It's dark, but a lot of deep cuts to Shakespeare, to comics history. It's definitely one of the kind of comic and graphic novel series that you could read by itself, but then you could also read with the Cliff Notes annotated, you know, context and with Wikipedia by your side. But that will be coming out. I just don't know exactly when, hopefully relatively soon. And Neil Gaiman is such a wonderful narrator. Have you listened to, you guys listen to any of his audiobooks?
Does he read his own?
No.
He does.
Oh, well.
He does. His Norse mythology one is especially good. That is it for the pop culture segment. Before we continue on, I want to let you know that this week's episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible by TurboTax. Everyone has to do taxes, and yet not everybody feels comfortable doing taxes, which doesn't seem right, especially when you consider all the amazing things these same people accomplish every day in our lives. TurboTax believes that with the right tools and encouragement, people can be good at anything, yes, even taxes. And to help people feel more comfortable about the tax process, TurboTax Live gives you personal access to experienced CPAs and EAs who are there for you even on nights and weekends. And they're happy to go through your return with you line by line to double check that you've done everything right, so you can be sure you get the best possible refund and 100% confident in your taxes. TurboTax, all people are tax people.
One bit of breaking news. So it was just announced the Warriors are going to play their next home game in an empty stadium. And it's the first American sports team to announce that. So I think we're going to start to see the sports events now go in quick succession.
Be really interesting to watch.
Huh? It'll be broadcast. Baseball has done it before.
And this has happened in many leagues. For various reasons.
Yeah. 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 Will they pipe in crowd sound?
Right.
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, do you play all the sounds during the game and the music? You know, like famously at like Sharks games and stuff, they would play like Super Mario Brothers music.
Right, like crowd rousing music.
Yeah,
or
and I was like, do you play that during?
Do they have the announcer?
Yeah, they have an announcer because they're broadcasting it.
No, no. Do you have the in-arena announcer?
Oh, like introducing the players and stuff?
Right. Or any of that, any of the production.
I think they're going to fireworks.
They need to make it as normal as possible for the players to play.
Well, and they normally fill the time with that, too. Like, that's all built into the schedule, I would think.
So the broadcasters will still be there reporting from the sidelines.
Interesting.
Maybe all the reporters will get the best seats now. That's going to be fun.
I don't know.
To watch.
Great.
Interesting.
Good.
Interesting. Okay, a little bit of a history lesson here with this piece of news. Apple is running a campaign, of course, promoting their iPhone 11 Pro, and they've been making these shot on iPhone videos. Like Lady Gaga had a big music video that was released last week that was entirely shot on the iPhone 11 Pro. Mm-hmm. It looked okay.
Yeah.
Right. And all of these are with a grain of salt because, you know, if you look at any of the behind the scenes pictures, these are iPhones with mounted on
steady cams,
yeah. Often using different lenses.
And no restrictions on the editing process.
Exactly. And they're using, of course, third party apps to add effects or even like things like anamorphic lenses, right? They're popped on. But you talk to the, you know, the interviews, you hear the interviews with the director of photographies for these, and they're like, oh, you know, we had these rigs set up, but it also allows for versatility because I could also film additional stuff handheld and I can then cut it however I want it, right? And I think, who was it? There was an action film director who did that big snowball fight. And you might have seen that TV commercial that was all filmed on iPhone 11.
Okay.
Again, very brightly lit, right? High key lighting to make the most of the camera sensor. Well, the newest shot an iPhone video was done in Russia at the Hermitage Museum. And not only is it a tour and a walkthrough of the museum, but there's choreographed performances, dance and musical performances throughout. And the idea is they shot this video in a single take, blocked it all out, and they shot it to be the duration of the iPhone battery. It is a 5 hour and 20 minute video in one take.
Yeah.
I haven't seen all 5 hours and 20 minutes of it. It's on YouTube. You can watch the whole thing uploaded in 1080.
I know this is one take, but how many times did they shoot it?
Once. They shot
That's it.
Because the museum was closing. I watched the behind the scenes, and so they had one shot, and there's this moment that is so incredible during the behind the scenes where they had it plotted to the second, and they're behind when they get to the shot, when they're going through, and there's one key, like, theatrical shot with, like, a ballet dancer that they need to get. And so they have to like skip a couple elements in their shot sheet to get there in time. Otherwise they lose that whole shot. And like them navigating that stuff, it was crazy.
So how do you like get 5 hours and 20 minutes of content? Well, it's a tour of the museum, one of the biggest museums in the world. There are 45 galleries. They focus on 588 different pieces of art as they go through. So you could actually watch this as almost a virtual tour of the museum.
Looks like it was shot in 60 frames a second.
They shot it 4K 60 and they uploaded on YouTube at 1080, but it might be at 4K if you watch it on Apple.com or on iTunes or something. But I think the more interesting thing, here's where the history lesson comes in, is that it's 100% a callback to a 2002 film called Russian Ark. Have you heard about this?
Nope.
Russian Ark was a 2002 film shot in the very same museum, but a narrative story. And it was done with a Sony HD cam, and not done with one battery, of course, but done in one take to film a 90-minute movie on one take in which they had to film it five times. And on the fifth time, if they had to stop for various reasons because of things that are offset, but they edited it down to edited the single take, stretched out some bits, slowed down some bits, but essentially became the first time you had this 90-minute movie in the same location, again, going through a museum. But in the Russian Arcs case, they had, you know, a whole cast and extras and ballroom dancing and everything. And then they worked around here. It was mostly an empty museum with some dancers and, you know, many hours more.
I really recommend the behind the scenes because you'll see how they were doing this technologically. Like they ended up, they made backup cameras.
They made, it was a rig with, they machined a rig that held three iPhones. One iPhone as their primary camera. They designed and built an app in 2 weeks so that they can adjust things like aperture. So the director, one iPhone was the main camera that they recorded on, and this was the one filled to battery capacity. The other one piped out a feed and streamed a video to the director to use and use more battery, of course, so the director could use that as a to direct, like exactly what Kishore said, to move scenes further up. And then they had a third iPhone, which was their backup iPhone. And the way it's rigged up, it's like, how do you mount three iPhones together so that they're all kind of looking at the same thing, but not obscuring the lenses? That itself was a funky rig. And then that rig itself was moved between handheld Steadicam to big jibs to things, because they had these big kind of arching shots. They had dolly tracks that were laid out on the floor. It was a whole big like pre-production effort. And at the end of behind the scenes, because they go down the staircase and there's this performer, I was wondering, like, did they shoot and plan this to die at 0%? Were they worried? Were they just go until very end? They had an ending point and they zoom in on the battery of the iPhone and it's at 19% battery. It didn't even get to low power. I guess when it goes to low power mode, they won't let you film the 4K video.
I was a little surprised there wasn't a battery pack in the rig for the phones, but whatever. Maybe that's part of the stunt.
Apparently the director could adjust things like the aperture, but they had an app to tie it to her Apple Watch. And so she could use Digital Crown to make setting adjustments on the fly.
Is there just one camera person the whole time?
I mean, they must have shifted between people.
I would certainly hope so, because that's a lot of walking around.
Yeah. Yeah. What an amazing effort. I mean, it is it's a stunt, right? It's a thing they did because they could. It's to showcase a technology, and you know, it is an advertisement for the phone. But I love that they called back to this 2002 film, and I love that they made the effort, because it's definitely interesting. And you know, it tells you, well, if you wanted to record video, you could record it for 5 hours and 20 minutes.
I mean, a lot of this is about the artwork. I thought it was all about going to be the dancers, but it kind of changes back and forth. I mean, this is a great
way. It's a virtual tour.
This is a wonderful way to see this museum.
Exactly. Now you just wish it was in VR. Imagine having to produce that and shoot that in VR.
Yes. Ooh. Step up, Oculus.
Sticking with Apple, we have, and you know, WWDC is still up in the air, but there are leaks already for iOS 14.
Yeah, well, we don't usually see this amount of a leak.
This is in the code leaks. And it has things that people expected, like an iPad Pro refresh that will have a triple camera array, just like the iPhone 11. And also things like cursor support in iPads is what people are expecting. But new product-wise, there's also reference to a new Apple TV box.
Yeah. The interesting thing is it appears that they may have refreshed the remote, which is much maligned.
Yeah. Did they make it big and not something you can lose instantaneously?
I do not know.
You know, if they're building cursor support in iPad, my hope is that they're going to put a cursor on screen for the Apple remote.
Oh, like the LG TVs.
Yeah, that's by far.
Accelerometer
control cursor. It's so much more intuitive than the swiping and...
I still don't feel like I've seen remotes get that quite right, the feel of that quite right.
Yeah. You compensate for it immediately. Like if you use the LG remote and you get it to the edge of screen, all you got to do is kind of realign, and then you basically have one-to-one.
I just want them to put a speaker in the remote so you can ding it. You know, I mean, it's the one item people have lost since they've been invented in the 80s.
That's why there are third-party accessories you can buy for that very purpose, to tag your remotes.
But it would be so easy to have the box be able to send a ping.
Yes.
And to, and in classic Apple fashion, to have that only be able to be controlled from your Apple phone.
Yeah.
Quibi.
Oh, yeah.
Is going to be launched soon. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about Quibi's, this is that streaming service launched by Jeffrey Katzenberg and a bunch of movie studios doing short form content, a subscription based short form content. And their big technological feature is what they call Turnstile, where you can rotate your phone and watch content in either portrait or landscape orientation. Well, that's a feature that apparently a video company called Echo. EKO.
They think they own
Quibi of stealing.
Yeah. Oh, patents are trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. So, don't know what's going to happen to Quibi. I'm sure they're going to launch this plan.
Judging by their marketing budget, I think they're going to afford to pay the patent.
But is this all this hubbub over this feature that I don't even know if people are going to use? It's interesting from a technology standpoint and from a filming standpoint, a content creation standpoint, because they're, you know, making a lot of content in like 6K footage and then editing it twice so it can be, and it can dynamically switch. But what if they find out people just want to watch the content in portrait mode or landscape mode?
Right. Yeah.
And it's one or the other.
Is TikTok only portrait?
I, as far as I know.
Yeah.
TikTok's only portrait.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
It's how people consume.
I don't think I've seen a landscape one. Yeah, I'm on TikTok. Weird.
It's all the kids watch.
It's the only thing they watch.
Yeah. we should put a podcast on TikTok.
Too long.
A little bit.
A little bit. I think it just works because you can watch a stream indefinitely. You just kind of watch and watch and watch and watch. And it's just bite-sized video.
Uh-huh.
Amazon has its Amazon Go technology. This is the checkout technology where they have cameras built into the stores and can basically use computer vision and machine learning to know what you are picking up, and then you can just walk out. And they apparently are going to license this technology to other retailers.
Yeah, no surprise there.
I think it's awesome, but I'm very curious how expensive it is, because like those rigs, like they have so many cameras in the ceiling. That can't be a cheap install.
You have no ceiling, essentially. You can't. Yeah. Basically, your store has to have what looks like a studio ceiling of just truss and mounted cameras.
It'll be like buying an electric car, where you can't think of it in terms of this year's cost. You got to think of it in the terms of the savings over the next 20 years.
That's their pitch,
yeah,
right? Here's what it's going to cost you with an asterisk over 10 years.
Exactly.
The idea, hopefully, is to expedite the checkout process and not to minimize the number of employees. And in fact, if you go to an Amazon store, a Go store, they have actually a surprising number of people inside the store fussing about rearranging items to better suit that computer vision camera. If you go to one, like they're constantly rearranging the soda cans and making everything. It's actually really great for people with OCD, because you walk in and you're like, wow, all the bags of chips are perfectly nulled out and laid out and nothing is messy because and everything is bright colored, like blue next to orange.
I thought you meant
green.
OCD was a good job qualification for the people doing that.
It's both.
Okay.
If you have OCD, then you would be great at that job because you would want to do nothing but get everything looking perfect. And if you have OCD yourself, then it's a very calming environment.
Wow. It's almost like you're speaking from experience. Wow.
Maybe. But I can think of, you know, if you go to think of like a retailer like Gap or something, like a clothing retailer, you know, they have people constantly folding the sweaters and putting them in neat arrangements. And this would probably make that more important if they were to employ this technology. You're not going to see the corners of some department store where all the baby shoes and clothes are just in a pile in the corner.
But you can't, like, they can't staff the same number of people. Otherwise, there's no incentive for the companies to, you know, deploy this kind of tech.
You hope the incentive isn't in the savings for
employees.
Jobs, because You don't want jobs to be taken away.
Well, no, you and I don't want that, but don't companies want that?
You hope that it encourages more traffic because the shopping experience is more convenient and faster, and you don't have to wait in lines.
That's nice.
The line process, the checkout process, especially in the holiday season, you just want to grab things and walk out and look at your app and get billed later.
That's tricky to, and if there's not a cost savings, I don't see companies adopting it.
Yeah, they have to do the math.
I mean, obviously you don't need the checkout technology.
Right. Right, but a lot of people also like the checkout experience because that's where they maximize, they min-max their shopping with, you know, points,
right.
Credit card points or, you know, rewards or whatever, or discounts.
It depends on the haggling. Consumer. This isn't the only tech that's going to be used. Like, all those traditional things are going to be there. But once you learn it and you see how much time you save, I think a lot of consumers will come over to it pretty quickly.
What type of store would you like to use this in, aside from a grocery store or convenience store?
Like Best Buy, like walk out with your 65-inch TV?
No. I actually think clothing stores, this would be great, because I think there's a lot of clothing stores, especially around like Christmas time, that I've been in that have like really hideous lines.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't be such a bad thing.
And that's tough too, because clothing by nature is less of a static product than something that's like in a defined shape, a package. So the packaging for clothing might change, right? You might have to buy clothing that looks like it's wrapped in, you know, a pouch rather than be able to take a garment and just throw it in a bag.
And even though I know it would be hard to do, is like, wow, if like a Target kind of big box store could have that
That's an scale.
Yeah, that's scale. Then it would be really hard to do because people are buying a lot of things.
Yeah.
And they're big stores.
Yeah.
Costco's and Target's. Wow.
But those are where the pain points are with lines. Like, you know, for like smaller boutique retailers, there's generally not like a long line for those places anyways.
I'd like to see it done in a restaurant. Maybe it's a cafeteria or a dim sum restaurant.
Interesting.
Where you go and you take the food you want and then you eat it and you leave. No payment.
I mean, we're almost there.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be that hard. Super, super close. Yeah. You don't even need the Amazon technologies for that. Like,
yeah.
Restaurants like Lemonade, basically cafeteria styles.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, you pay there.
You pay, but like,
get to the end of the line.
They could easily, you don't need the computer vision technology.
But I want to go back and I don't want to wait in line and I just want to get the food. Mm. Yeah.
And then last bits of tech news, Horizon Zero Dawn, very successful, very great Sony PlayStation 4 game, is coming to PC this summer.
Good looking game.
Yeah.
I played it right after I played Breath of the Wild, and it was too complicated for me. And I couldn't climb everything.
Oh, okay. You know, I can feel.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of hints and a lot of ways for you to play. It's open world, but you can also just go toward the main story objectives. Gorgeous game.
My son loved it. He finished it.
Great game to take advantage of 4K HDR, which is another reason to play it on a console and not necessarily on your PC. But if you have it, if you want to play on a PC and you have a good PC, then this summer. And then Black Mesa is out. This is the remake of Half-Life 1.
The game that changed everything.
I saw Will play it on his stream the other night.
Both Will and Gary are loving it.
It looks so good.
Yeah, they recommend people who never played the first game don't, and they just play this.
So, I mean, I agree. Like, I wouldn't agree for Half-Life 2, and there is no equivalent for Half-Life 2.
Right.
I think playing Half-Life 1, if you've never played it, it will not hold up. Because you don't have games have moved on. I mean, it was the thing that started it all. But these kind of narrative, kind of real world esque games, like Half-Life 1 worked because it came out in the era of Quake, and it was such a departure from Quake and Unreal.
Yeah.
And this is from the Crowbar Collective, and
it's not free.
It's not. Yeah, that's right.
It's $20, I believe, on Steam.
Is that it?
Which is interesting because it's. It's based on a Valve property.
I think it's kind of, they have the blessing.
Yeah.
Of Valve.
Good on Valve.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean, and also Half-Life is free, for you know from now until
right for the time being
for the time being
and then yeah. it's going to go back to like $3
yeah exactly
I was going to say you know Half-Life was re-released recently on in VR for mm-hmm. Quest and mm-hmm. a lot of people have played that for the first time
that's a different experience though
mm-hmm.
and that's a level of graphics fidelity that actually could work well on Quest
right it's the right level
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, Black Mesa looks like, it's not like a reskinning. It is a remake.
You're right in that it's not just the textures. There's new geometry,
right.
and the levels are redone, but it's the same layout, though, and the same story and the same sound.
Do you think they had the original, they remade the original assets and like sort of kept the architecture and everything in place?
Yeah, I mean, they expanded in certain things so like you could see further out, but like mm-hmm. if you had to spend X number of time in crates or like in the ducts
yeah.
in Half-Life, a lot of Half-Life was spent in those ventilation ducts, yeah. right? Die Hard Simulator.
Yeah.
You have to do the same thing in Black Mesa.
Right.
Yeah, they didn't tighten that up.
I see. Yeah. So it's not like a refresh of the game design itself.
No.
More modernized.
No. Yeah.
All right.
And that does it for technology news.
Moment of science.
All right. The usual qualifications apply. Vetted sources. Where you get your information is really important. I'm going to say don't panic again, but I'm going to qualify that. Like, we can't just keep saying don't panic and not end that sentence. It's don't panic because, and I'm going to fill in the because here in a few minutes. But this is going to be a positive segment on COVID, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So first, it'll take us a little bit to ramp into there. The WHO just this morning declared this a pandemic, and I'm here to tell you, like I said, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago on this podcast, it doesn't really mean anything. The definition for pandemic is variant between what the WHO and what people think about it. They tend to be hesitant about using it because it instills some level of panic in the population. And at this point, panic isn't typically helpful. Whether it's a pandemic or not, it's still the same serious disease that it was yesterday and will be tomorrow as well. I don't put much stock in that. And so if you hear a lot of media reports about now it's officially a pandemic, it really doesn't mean that.
And
much.
It's officially a pandemic worldwide, right?
Pandemic means a worldwide event. Okay, so some news. So there was a study that came out of Germany where they studied 9 patients that had COVID-19 and were studying when they were actually shedding virus. And this is important because, you know, a virus's whole job, its whole existence is based off of invading a host, building more copies of itself, and then making those copies go to other hosts. That's its whole purpose in living. And viruses don't actually want to kill their host. They just want to make copies of themselves. They're very predictable in that way. So what they were studying is, so when is this actually shedding? Because with SARS, which is a very like a related virus to this coronavirus, it shed well after symptoms appeared and the virus had already embedded, caused pneumonia-like infections deep in your lungs. What they found in this is that the shedding of viruses is happening much earlier with COVID-19, and it's happening before some patients are actually seeing any symptoms. This is a big deal. This is only 9 patients in Germany, but it's a big deal because it means that it's not just about sort of isolating who's sick and whatnot. It's about controlling who actually comes in contact with other people, because that's how you potentially reduce the spread. There's positive news here, too, that the amount of time the virus was spreading is much less than initially thought. That was limited to about 8 days total versus some of the initial estimates of 2 weeks. That's like a half of that time that we think. So that's very positive news.
Can you define what that means?
That means the amount of time that you're actually infectious.
Ah, contagious.
Mm-hmm. People say 2 weeks. 5 to 7 days.
This isn't like saying, I'm not telling anyone like, oh, after a week, fine, go out, do stuff. This is just like us trying to very structurally understand what the shedding load. This is very small population. But if it's shorter than a two-week period, this is very good news for the potential control of the spread.
That's a variable when they do the projections.
So every time you hear the idea of like stay home for 2 weeks, it's based off of studies that are looking at how long people are infectious for. Now, this is, you know, very early data. Again, I'll qualify it again. But that's very positive news. I'm going to rewind us a week. When I dialed in last week, I had Jeremy put up this this blog post from Trevor Bedford, who's a scientist at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center, and he works on something called the Seattle Flu Study. And what we're looking at was a graph of them analyzing the gene sequences of virus that from China versus people in the U.S. and trying to track transmission. And we had talked about how they had identified with this group a person that came from Wuhan to Seattle that was the originator of a lot of the viruses they were seeing in the Seattle area and how they were tracking it. And there was a point in the story when I was talking last week when I mentioned they knew the initial case came in late January. And then they were looking for more cases. And then I sort of fast forwarded and I said the next test where they identified something was at the end of February. So they thought this person was loose for 5 or 6 weeks. And that's part of a larger story that came out in the New York Times yesterday and was part of the Daily. So this group is a research group that is monitoring flu spread in that area. And they're one of the most equipped groups in the United States.
They had already been monitoring flu spread.
And so in a weird way, we are very lucky that in the U.S. that the virus hit Seattle, because this group was sitting there waiting for it.
Waiting.
And what we found out in the New York Times story that's been intimated elsewhere and just wasn't fully public yet is why there was that month-long period. So they had seen something happening and they wanted to test for it. But the FDA and CDC said they couldn't run those tests because as a research group, they weren't something called CLIA certified. CLIA is a regulation that protects user data and handling of user samples. And so to make sure there's chain of custody, that there's quality controls in place, that they're done in specific environments, this is a very good law. The CLIA law is why Theranos fell down as a company last year. Or 2 years ago, because the CLIA inspector went and saw they weren't actually doing the blood test properly. So, like, this is an important regulation, and we should not, like, throw it out. But in the case of where we were with this, that regulation and the bureaucratic adherence to it prevented them from running the test. The CDC and the FDA, who the FDA actually governs the sort of CLIA certification, would not let them run tests to see where this was spread. And it took sort of a massive amount of movement and lots of appeals and emergency appeals for them to be able to run it. And they never got approval and just said, fuck it. And they ran it anyways. And that's how they found the February 28th case. And that's when stuff started to change. It's a story of bureaucracy getting in its own way in a time when we needed it to function very differently. And it's a good read. You should listen to the Daily on this. But I just want to say, like, the people that I was highlighting last week that was doing that work, they're the people behind that. And they're still doing that work right now. And this country has an amazing capacity in that kind of way to actually analyze people. And while our testing hasn't sort of lived up to that yet, we still that a lot of that is now coming online because of the failures of that month period. That month period is a terrible thing, and it's probably going to cost some people their lives. But at least now we're sort of on a progress forward. So last night we crossed 1,000 diagnosed cases in the U.S. We think there's a lot more, both based off of the work of Trevor and some of the Seattle flu study people, and just projections from epidemiologists around the country. But we've seen a ramp. So on February 26th, we had 15 diagnosed cases. On March 4th, which was a week ago, we had 111. And on March 10th today, we have more, or March 11th, I guess, we're above 1,000. That is a classic exponential growth curve that we're seeing. And I want to show you what happens when exponential growth curves come under control. This is a chart that Helen Branswell from Stat put out yesterday.
Let's describe it for podcast audio listeners.
This is the curve of cases in Korea. And what we see here is an exponential growth curve in the number of cases. So it starts on, I think, February 19th is the first case. And you see a curve rise all the way through, I would say, March 3rd. It's on a full exponential path.
Yeah. It's going to hockey puck or a hockey stick.
So if it keeps going on an exponential curve, that means everyone's going to be sick. But what starts to happen with all of these curves inside of public health situations is they form what's called logistic curves. There's a really good 3 Blue 1 Brown video on this. And I'll put a link to that video. But what starts happening, it starts leveling off. And as it levels off, the number of cases are still rising, but the rate of growth is going down. And so what we're seeing on the South Korea curve right now, and it's apparent in the last week, is the curve is bending. It means the rate of progression and number of cases is slowing down pretty dramatically. And with a logistic curve, if it holds to the mathematical way that these are hold, there's a midpoint. It's called an inflection point. If you double the inflection point, you can usually predict where it's going to level off. And the inflection point for this South Korea curve is around 4,000 cases, a little bit more. That means they'll end up at around 8,000 positive cases. And right now they're at 7,700. So they're going to quickly probably slow down if this curve holds. The reason this curve changed was not because the virus stopped spreading. And it wasn't because of government intervention. There was certainly a lot of testing, and there's lots of people that will point to how many tests Korea did. Most public health officials say the reason this changed is because the population took it so seriously that they implemented social distancing measures, they prevented transmission in hospitals, and they tested the heck out of everybody, right? And those social distancing measures matter now. Not a month from now, they matter right now, because that's how they got that curve under control. And as soon as we bend that curve, this thing will have a light at the end of the tunnel. But when you're on the exponential growth curve, like we are here in the US, we don't know what the rate of that exponential curve is going to be, because we're just going up. So we don't know when it flips. But this is a positive sign that it can happen, and it can happen quickly. But it happened not because of some magical government intervention or something else. It happened because people did the right things. They made hard choices early in the intervention. So they started social distancing measures in Korea. But like by, I think it was February 24th or 25th, they started to be implemented. The first case was like, it started to ramp like February 19th. We're kind of in that similar time frame right now in the U.S. This is when it matters.
Okay, so specifically, you're talking about keeping six foot distance between other people. Don't shake hands.
So the number one thing,
don't go to big events.
The number one thing is, like, when you start to combine these stories that I just talked about, it's like, one, we have to ramp up testing. That's actually happening. That's sort of out of our control. There's going to be some accountability that has to come months from now, but for now, testing ramps up.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
As of last week, it seemed like the only people being tested in America were people who were so sick that they had to go to the hospital. And then you stood a good chance of getting tested, but not even 100%. Are we at the point yet where we're testing more people?
We're testing more people, but we're still in that regime you're talking about.
Okay.
Where we're testing sick people. Mm-hmm. And we need to move to where we're not just testing sick people. We're testing people that are starting to show signs. Like, it can't just be we test only the people that are sick.
Then you're
because
behind,
if you combine
weeks
that,
behind.
You're weeks behind where the infection is. So this doesn't sound positive yet, but the number one thing, test people. Number two is, guess what, everyone? We're all public health experts now. Like, we need to stop having large gatherings. Just this morning, the governor of Washington State said banned gatherings of more than 250 people. Santa Clara County banned gatherings of more than 1,000 people. The reason this is happening is because people probably are infected and are shedding virus, but they don't know it. So if we put them in situations where they're doing that, where there's a large number of people around them, we're going to accelerate the spread. So taking this simple step, which doesn't sound, first, I want to acknowledge, it's not that appealing to like put your entire life on hold in this way. And it's hard to do, like we're humans. But it's the most effective measure. There's no other, there's no solution that's coming down from the mountaintop. This is how we solve it. And so my message is, this is our turn now. Like, there's no public health expert that, in frank, like, frankly, there's no expert for this. There's a million experts that have to work on this. But at this point, we're all the experts. Like, that is the position we're in. And our expertise means we need to avoid large gatherings. We need to stay home if we're sick. We need to be open and communicative. We need to not panic because we need to still live our lives. But more importantly, it's like when we shift the conversation from, hey, this is something that, you know, like hospitals and these professionals are going to come help me with, to like, no, this is something that I have control over, that I can help with. And that's how we're going to bend the curve. I think that changes it to being a much more optimistic view, because now it's just like, let's band together and just do this, because in a matter of weeks, we could be past this if we do it right. If we don't, we could be in a whole lot of trouble.
Does the geography of the United States and the way the population is spread and distributed have any effect on this versus a country like South Korea?
We don't know. I mean, there's some theories that I've seen and some papers written about denser populations versus not. The thing is, like, we have enough dense population centers that if it spreads there, it doesn't matter, right? Like, if it spreads in Chicago and that's a 10 million, you know, population greater area, then it's spreading in a population of 10 million people. Maybe if you're in like rural Kansas, that won't mean you come in contact with them very often, but it's still bad in terms of the number of cases that develop. I don't think there's really good data saying that the way the systems work, that we won't see spread throughout the U.S. It's already here is the way I think you should be thinking about it. Have you heard of flatten the curve?
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay. This is fairly important. So why do we do all of this? And we do all of it because of a simple idea called flatten the curve. And I'll put a link to some graphics. They're all over Twitter. This one I put up is from a microbiologist from New Zealand, Susie Wiles. But the idea is, if we do this social distancing, we're not actually going to stop the virus from spreading. It'll still probably get to most of the pockets of the U.S. But what we're doing is we're buying the healthcare system time to deal with the people that are sick. Because if the ICU here in San Francisco, it has sick people in it right now that have COVID-19, and we keep meeting in massive packs and herds, and more people get sick really rapidly, that ICU can quickly get overrun. And then the outcomes for those people is really bad in terms of mortality. That's what's happening in Italy right now. But if we like take some of these personal measures, we can delay that. Like, maybe what we're doing is buying those people in the ICU another week before more cases start to come in. That makes all the difference in the world, because that person has a chance to get better in the ICU. And then they can get off like the ventilator and maybe go home or get transferred somewhere else. Where that week is going is the difference between a 2% mortality rate and a 0.7% mortality rate.
Jeez.
So right now in Italy, the CFR, the case fatality rate, as I explained a couple of weeks ago, is around 3.5%. In South Korea right now, it's 0.7%. That's the difference our individual actions have, because those hospitals only have so many respirators, so many beds, so many healthcare staff to take care of these people. Because if you have to put somebody on a ventilator, it takes three people to run that machine 24/7 to keep that person alive. This flattening the curve isn't hard for us to do. It is literally us not congregating together as a population can have this effect very quickly.
Did the infection start around the same time period in both countries?
In which countries?
South Korea and Italy.
I have to look at the data, but I think reasonably close. Hmm. But I look at all this as super positive. I look at this and I say, oh, for the next like 2 or 3 weeks, I have to be really cognizant of my behavior. I have to like, I'm not washing hands because I'm worried about me getting sick. I'm doing it because I'm helping all of the other people that are getting sick to give them a chance to get better. And that just helps our entire system work. I'm going to leave you with a quote from a scientific paper that came out this morning that I think is that it just says, it says, individual behavior will be crucial to control the spread of COVID-19. Personal rather than government action in Western democracies might be the most important issue. And I think we need to think about it that way right now. And for me, that is 100% a positive sign for the future, because I'm not waiting on some magical cure. It is our turn to work together now. It's hard work, but it's something that's eminently doable, because we've seen in a country of 50 million people do it over the course of a month.
Washing your hands for 20 seconds. What are your songs? What are the jingles? You
Happy Birthday Twice.
Have you not seen the Vietnam Wash Your Hands song?
No.
Oh, it is so incredible.
Oh, John Oliver.
Yes.
Oh, okay. While you dig that up, sure, I do.
Do you want me to play it?
Yeah, if you can. Yeah. Space is Final Frontier. Wash Your Hands and just do an opening. Starship credits.
Oh, right. That's what you use?
Final Frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship.
Oh, you recite.
I recite the whole thing.
Okay.
While washing my hands.
Like as quickly as you can.
No. You got, and that's one that you don't do as quickly as you can, because that's one you got to do with the gravity of a Jean-Luc Picard or a Spock. Space, the final frontier, and it gives you natural breaking points to change the way you wash your hands, the direction.
Is this what you want to play?
Oh, I think, I don't know.
How Southeast Asia is using catchy pop songs to combat coronavirus.
Is there a song? Find the place in the song first. We'll play the song real quick, just for a few seconds, and then we'll move on to our next story.
I have a couple more science stories that are really quick. So one, we talked about this about a month ago. NASA was having a competition to name their rover.
Mars rover, yes.
And I won on this podcast. I suggested Perseverance.
And that's what it's called.
Perseverance won.
Perseverance.
Thank you, NASA, for listening to my vote. Your voice matters if you're me.
No 1-900 number needed.
And the last thing I'll show you is a really, really freaking cool series. So I have a video up on the screen, but essentially what you're seeing is a man with a prosthetic limb, and he's controlling it. And what's amazing is the amount of control he has with his opposable thumb. And the way this prosthetic actually works is they went in with a surgery and took some of the nerves at the end and wrapped it around electrical coils on the prosthetic for them to control. And this has the added benefit of, there are these lingering pains that amputees tend to have with those missing nerves. And by coiling these nerves around the prosthetic, they found that they dealt with that pain in addition to giving this like extra bit of control. So that person with that prosthetic was able to actually pick up blocks like the size of Legos and move them from place to place. All of this is controlled with your mind.
That's awesome.
I don't know. I don't think this will get us a copyright violation.
I don't think you're playing the right song.
I think this.
No, this is a song.
This is a pop song.
Okay.
In where? Vietnam? Yeah. About coronavirus. It's teaching people about the virus.
All right. Here we go.
Wrong one. Let's stay determined is the translation. That this disease doesn't catch fire. Let's wash our hands, rub them.
Yes, that is the song.
Is it?
Yes, but there's a TikTok dance meme where people are taking this song and then also dancing, choreographing to it.
I think it's great.
And I'm going to send you the link, Jeremy, because you can play this one on the screen.
Well, that's for Kishore then.
If you...
He's screen enabled. Oh, you want me to airplay it up there?
No, Kishore can do it. Okay. If you Google on YouTube, TikTok dance challenge to fight coronavirus spread, you will find this for those of you just listening to the audio. And it's from Inside Edition, I think is the YouTube channel. Here you go, Kishore. I just sent it over to you. This is what was played on John Oliver. And this is what we need to do. Well, no, you actually need to wash your hands, but this is what you should watch because it's super catchy. Play the music.
He can't.
Oh, you can't play the music.
I told you that. I'd have to airplay it.
You got to sync it up. Anyway.
We got it.
We got to move on. Oh, we're doing it. Okay.
It's the same song.
Dance about preventing
And it's a report. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But you got to watch the song. Okay. You got to watch the video. Anyway, let's move on to VR.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality this week.
I know we told folks out there that we wouldn't try our best to make the podcast not just about the video, and I apologize about that last segment because I got too enamored with the video.
Well, I tried to play it.
I know, but okay. I shouldn't have asked you to play it in the first place, Jeremy. That was my point.
They're all washing their hands right now to that song.
That's right.
It's cool.
Okay, only a little bit of VR news this week because we are now less than 2 weeks away from the release of Half-Life Alyx. Valve Index went back on sale earlier this week, quickly sold out for the window of delivery for Half-Life Alyx's release date on March 23rd. But I believe if you go on the Steam website, you can still place an order and it's like 8 to 10 weeks for delivery.
You don't need an Index to play Half-Life Alyx.
You don't need an Index to play Half-Life Alyx, but you only can play Half-Life Alyx once. The first time, once.
Oh, come on,
you play
man.
As many times as you want, but you can only play it the first time once. And there are people out there who have the PCs and who maybe only want to play it on the Index, and I completely understand that.
Yeah.
If you want to maybe just use the Index controllers, you can get a Vive Pro and play it on original Vive and play it with those controllers. Speaking of the Vive Pro, HTC has actually discontinued the Vive Pro and the Vive Focus, but they've replaced it with the newest updated version, which is the Vive Pro I. So unfortunately, more expensive.
Well, that's with the eye tracking, right?
It's with the eye tracking, but for consumers, you don't need that. It's really a business or developer headset.
Dude, you say that, but it's got to be in the next generation of consumer headsets.
Sure, but whether this implementation of eye tracking will meet the standards or if there will be a standard, that's up there. I think they're doing this really to point people more toward the Cosmos on the consumer side, because a lot of people are still going for that Vive Pro on the consumer side. And I guess if you want to, it costs a little bit more. Valve also last week after recording the podcast released environment, Steam Home environment.
Oh yeah.
Based off of Half-Life Alyx. They only work if you have an Index, but you can host a public channel and people with other VR headsets can join your channel, and there are workarounds if you want to get in there. And it's gorgeous. Have either of you gone in the Steam Home environments?
Negative.
There's a City 17 like street alleyway environment, and then there's one inside a laboratory. If you can't wait the 2 weeks to experience Half-Life Alyx for the first time, then go ahead, download them, and it will give you a good sense of the visual fidelity, of the detail of these worlds, and they look fantastic. I think a lot of the people that have used it are coming out of it saying, I couldn't believe that how great the environments look, and I think they're going to look even better in the final game because of the increase in density of assets and all the physics objects and interactivity, of course. But it gives you a real good sense of like how Half-Life Alyx might even perform on your system.
I just think it's a cool promotion because we used to do, like, the best thing we had was a screenshot. right? Like,
sure.
And we'd get like the best screenshots and we'd put them on the cover of a magazine and that'd be like the best thing ever.
Now you can be in that environment.
You can freaking be in the game before it ever ships.
I mean, it's what Oculus wanted to do with the Rift, the store. So remember when they first launched the Rift, the idea was not only would you watch a game trailer, but in the library, in the menu, you'd download the assets and get kind of a virtual environment that you could look around
right,
in
yeah, yeah.
that would be made just for the store. And I think to make that asset became cost prohibitive for developers, and they couldn't get everyone on board on it. And so that was shelved. But Valve, you know, are happy to do it.
It's great.
I do think that it's not so much a spoiler in terms of story, but it does take away from some of that first aha experience.
It can't be more of a spoiler than the trailers were. I mean, that certainly.
The trailers, but you don't. Yes, I agree. But some people have spent, you know, hours inside these team home environments now.
What?
Picking through every object,
really?
Looking at book covers, looking at things.
Yeah.
And
so there's a lot of things you can pick up?
There are plenty of things you can look at and pick up.
Yeah.
And some people, there's one guy who even, there's a Citadel, right?
In
City 17, the center. He even took the time and spent 4 hours climbing or, you know, virtually getting himself closer to the Citadel.
He hacked a way to get through the boundary and climbed the Citadel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Climb, quote unquote. Climb the Citadel. Yeah. Just through continual effort.
Yes.
I mean, that's how obsessed the fans are.
Cool.
Game of Force comes out on the 23rd, so it's only a matter of time. We're going to get it real soon. Lots of bits of Live, the mixed reality app, now supports Oculus Quest, and which means you could do Beat Saber, Super Hot, and a small selection of other games, and film mixed reality videos while you can. The person in VR can be using the Quest headset, and you can film them even without a green screen by using an iPhone with an AR kit.
Really?
Yeah. So it really takes a lot of that processing and a lot of the setup needed.
So is Live software running on the Quest?
There's Live software running on the Quest.
Is that sideloaded?
I think it's sideloaded. I don't know exactly how it syncs up with
the
games, the game content. I think it's got to be syncing up data and then rendering it on a separate computer, the external view.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I can't imagine that the Quest is rendering multiple, like another view initially. It could be.
The fact that it's running code at all in sync with it, with a game, and transmitting that somehow to the PC, that's pretty neat, hacky stuff.
I gotta go check in with David from Liv, who came by our studios, help us film that and
lift the curtain, find out how they're doing that magic.
And then Facebook AI researchers have put out a paper saying that they think that they can get VR rendering optimized with some machine learning.
This and DSP is just a little treasure trove.
And give apps 67 2/3 more GPU processing power.
Whoa. Yeah. This DSP is what they're running hand tracking on. And that it's what the before that they were using it for something else. I forget what it is.
One of the time warps? One of the space warps?
Maybe. Yeah, but it's just like it just keeps unwrapping new features, and now they're able to run machine learning in real time on it, and basically allow the game to run at a lower resolution globally, and then use machine learning to dial up the resolution to like have invent resolution and pixels that were never rendered.
So we're not talking about super sampling in terms of textures,
no.
Which there are GPU tricks that you can do to fill in texture detail, but actual geometry and sharpness.
It's upsampling the images. It's zoom and enhance.
Yeah.
It's exactly what that is. You know, it's the feature that we all laughed at, said couldn't be done. Now it can be done. You can even, like, there are websites that you can upload images to have them, you know, up-resed, but not using traditional algorithms, like actually using machine learning. So it invents the information that isn't actually there.
With a database that it has trained on.
Exactly.
So it's good enough to convince you that that data is there, but of course the data may not actually be representative
right.
of what was actually shown. But you might not care. All you want to see is something sharp in the headset.
You know, the DSP is used for the controller tracking. That's what it is.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why it doesn't impact performance on games.
Mm-hmm. Controllers, whether it's hand controllers or your hands.
Yeah. What a great, just incredible engineering.
Good for Qualcomm.
Yeah. But I mean, the more that they realize they can do with the DSP, the more you realize they're going to want a big fat one or two of them in future headsets.
Yes, yes. All this research hopefully informs hardware decisions for the next generation. Virtual desktop also got a big update to version 1.1.
Well, now you can run Oculus games wirelessly.
Wirelessly.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Rift games.
Yes.
Wirelessly. And you, by not having to run Steam VR, and then Revive to, you know, hack into your Oculus account via Steam.
And having to do the weird setup.
Yeah.
Because you have to kind of previously create your Steam setup and multiple layers of interfaces.
He fixed that. So the Steam setup now inherits your Quest setup.
Got
so
it.
That's like easier.
Good,
but
good.
Now you don't have to launch Steam at all to run Oculus games. You just launch your Oculus games. And it doesn't work with every one of them. There is a database, a Google Doc, where it lists all the compatibilities. But a lot of games just work.
And it's running locally on your desktop PC, so you still need that. But
still,
it's being streamed.
Presumably, it doesn't incorporate Time Warp in the same. So, you know, if Oculus were to come out with a wireless link option, that still might be the best thing. But so you might be getting an extra frame of latency using this solution. But still, this is the only game in town
for right now.
It's great.
Yeah, I mean, you do need, you know, the hardware. You need a good
PC.
You need a PC, but you also need the router signal, 5G connection.
And he's saying that
5G, but a 5 gigahertz.
Yeah. He's saying that some people were using cheap bandwidth. ISP provided routers are not experiencing great performance.
Yeah.
Like you do need a good router. To make it sing. Yeah.
And I think that does it for the VR Minute. I should have an episode of Projections up later this week. I do play The Room VR.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll show some footage from that.
Did you like it?
I really like it.
Yeah.
It's
looking good.
I'm excited for the full game. And that's coming out March 26th.
Oh, this month.
Yeah.
Cool.
Same week as Alex.
Is that on Quest?
It's on Quest.
Nice.
And other platforms as well. I played on Quest.
All right, time for our last segment. It's Picard time.
Oh, yeah. Check it out. I got the song ready to go.
Make it so.
Red alert!
Picard. Spoiler warning. Spoiler warning.
I've lost contact, sir.
What?
Engage.
Picard.
Yeah, it says right there.
It's like I melted.
Should we start with a quick, like, 1 minute recap?
Well,
of what?
We
of
have episode. Not talked about the last three episodes.
What? What have you guys been doing?
Last two episodes, technically. There are three episodes we haven't talked about. Will and Jeremy didn't recap their episode.
I didn't want to do it without you.
All right. Well, that's too far in the past.
That's too far. But we got to do last two episodes.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay. Right? Why don't you recap six? I'll recap seven.
No, I want to recap seven. You recap six.
I don't remember. What happens in six? They're on the Borg cube, right?
I can tell you what happened in six because I watched the recap of six. That's all I saw of it.
Oh, okay. Do it.
So Picard, he in five finds out where she is. He goes to the Borg cube.
Mm-hmm. Five is the one with seven of nine.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
I'm throwing numbers.
Infiltration
field you. Five. That went in five.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Why is six afraid of seven?
Yeah. There you go.
So goes to the Borg cube. Evil Romulan boyfriend tries to murder her after finding out her homeworld.
Yes,
and by putting her into like a Zen state, and then but she activates, bashes through the floor.
Yep.
And escapes with Picard. Like appears with Picard. He's like Soji, it's you. And she says, and she says, yes, it's me. Who am I? And then they run off into some sort of Borg teleporter. Hugh saves them.
So well, let's stop there. Okay.
Why?
No. Let's finish the recap and we'll come back to the teleporter.
Okay.
What?
Go ahead. Continue.
Yeah, so Hugh saves them. Off they go into some kind of Borg teleporter. And Hugh stays behind with a Vulcan Defender man.
He's Romulan.
Is he Romulan?
Elnor.
Elnor.
How do you know he's Romulan?
Because the episode that you and Will didn't talk about is the episode that talks about how they recruit Elnor.
He's a Romulan monk, basically.
Okay. He's a Romulan
orphan
assassin nun.
Yeah, but that's why I went with monk. Whatever.
He was raised by Romulan nun assassins.
Yeah,
they're assassins.
The family that he was raised with,
the ladies,
yes, are this assassin nuns.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
that this is take up helpless causes, hopeless causes, and they train this young boy to be the first of them.
But they always look for a home for... They want another home for him.
They could not find a home for him.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a thread to pull on.
And Picard didn't come back for him. So he has this daddy issue with Picard.
Right.
But he is loyal to Picard.
He takes him as his cause. I felt like the lead nun was so far maybe my favorite actress in the entire show. She was fantastic.
Even more than the Romulan, the Tal Shiar farm workers, his Picard's confidants.
No, those are great characters. But her acting, I felt like she was amazing. I wanted more of her. Okay, so that's the episode I didn't watch.
Okay, well, let's recap that episode a little bit. Talk about it a little more, because it was the reunion of Picard and Hugh of Borg, and that was one of the most touching moments of the show so far. Everyone thought that the Picard 7 of 9 encounter, and we talked about this, Kishore, would have more weight, and it really, for me, felt a little flat until that moment at the end where Picard and Seven have that talk about being ex-Borg, and really, the connection between Hugh and Picard, it brought back their entire relationship, all the appearances he had in Next Generation. You know, the Picard's, how proud he was of Hugh. Oh my God, that made me tear up.
Also, you see Picard struggling when he gets on the artifact. He's having a flood of memories back from when he was Locutus, and he's really having all these like kind of visions from that time period. So you can see that he is not fully healed from that time.
Let's also agree that XB is a terrible moniker, a terrible name for the ex-Borg. Calling them XBs, it just doesn't sound good.
Nope. It's right up there with JL.
Yeah, agreed. But the Locutus aspect, the fact that he was so disoriented, and the other ex-Borgs and people who were there, even one turned around and said, Locutus? The moment? That was crazy.
Huh.
And that really felt a little bit like a filler episode in order to get Soji and Picard together and to get to episode 7.
I was perfectly happy missing that episode.
Except for the moments, if you cared about the Hugh and Picard relationship.
Which I didn't. I don't really care about.
Well, I think there's two details from 6 that we should just mention. So the Zen, I think them discovering this home planet that Soji is apparently from or was constructed in is critical to the plot.
Sure.
So they got that out of the way, and they got a betrayal out of the way. So now she's on the side of good. And then the teleporter.
Oh, yes. That was a callback to a Voyager episode, a spatial trajector used by the Sicarians, that Hugh says. And he knows this because, of course, all the Borg share knowledge.
Yeah, so this is a race in the Delta Quadrant that actually comes up in a Voyager episode, which has invented this world-to-world teleporter technology. And they're racing to not be assimilated by the Borg, because it'll give the Borg enormous power.
Because they have a range of 40,000 light years, which spans the galaxy, essentially.
And they don't get assimilated in that Voyager episode, but it does look like that they've assimilated the technology by now.
Yes.
So is there some limit to that teleporter's abilities?
No, it's a magic technology.
Wow.
I mean, the way they framed it seemed to be that they could only use it a limited number of times because it was an emergency escape hatch, essentially, for the Queen.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the first time the Queen was mentioned on the show, and there are now simmering theories that the reason the Romulans fear Soji and Daj is because, if you think about Star Trek First Contact, the Borg wanted to simulate Data because they saw him as a perfect being.
Mm.
And at the end of Voyager, the Queen is killed by Janeway, in the future Janeway. It's a whole thing with Voyager. There's time travel involved. The Borg are essentially crippled. And one of the theories is the Borg are interested, or that the Romulans are afraid of Soji being Destroyer because she is destined to be a Borg queen.
Mm. Okay, theory. On to episode 7.
Okay, this was what we've been waiting for the whole time. It took 7 episodes to get there, but it was Picard and Riker and Troi.
I loved this episode.
So good.
Okay, recap. Go.
Okay, Picard and Soji land on this planet. The name of it is Nepenthe, and it's the teasers for this episode were not good because they had like all this ominous. Are we safe? Are we not safe? It's very clear they're safe. They meet Riker and Troi's daughter. First of all, Wonderful performance by this little girl.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. She helps serve the purpose of exposition and helps you know, get the story out from Soji, helps, you know, reveal some details of her memories. And then they find where Riker and Troi have now retired, this home they have. And you learn, they don't explicitly mention the Titan and their time, Riker's time commanding, being the captain of this ship that we saw at the end of Nemesis, but why they have settled, why they no longer explore the stars. And then they talk about this theme about what if you live your life aboard this ship, you have no home planet. And raising this family, they had a son, they had this daughter, they had no home world. And so they settled here to have a home world, and also because they lost their son.
And that's crucial. And I wanted to ask you guys, that is new information,
that is
right?
100% new information. Okay. And the way it was not just kind of shoved down, you know, like, and just told the exposition, but the way it was performed by Marina Sirtis, mm-hmm, as a grieving mother, that was, mm-hmm, incredible. That was, yeah, one of the best performances of the show
so far. It served as the reason why Picard and Troi couldn't, mm-hmm, join Picard.
Finish the recap, and we'll talk about the themes.
So it's a little bit reminiscent of almost Endgame, and the Tony Stark retiring and having this cabin in the middle of a forest.
Pretty sure it was the same cabin.
It wasn't the same cabin. It was evocative of that cabin for sure. But they use this episode as a way for, basically, they have their ready room moment. They kind of problem solve and think about their next steps, and they kind of renew their energies. And Picard and Soji then find they find their next place they have to go and re meet up with Rios, his ship.
And just to fill in the other storylines, Jurati, it shown in a flashback, shows that she encountered the Commodore that's in charge, mm-hmm, of Starfleet security, and she convinces her that synthetics are an evil and gives her essentially a tracking device to spy on Picard. And then we see her kind of come to terms with that she's being a traitor for bad reason, and she puts herself into a coma to disable the tracking.
Well, you skipped the part where she killed the love of her life.
That was a previous episode.
Oh. And we talked about
prior. Yes.
And Narek was using that tracking device to chase down the La Serena.
So head of Federation Security was working with Narek and the Romulan Tal Shiar.
Yeah. And so, and then the other storyline is Elnor and Hugh trying to survive the Romulans aboard. Mm-hmm. And they manage to escape, but a lot of the X-Borg are killed. And they get into a fight with Narek's sister.
Yes.
And Narek's sister kills Hugh. And Elnor, like, we think he escapes and is headed back to the central area to activate the...
I think he's still on the run.
Yeah, he's on the run, but I think the hope is that he'll find an X-Borg to activate some element of the cube.
He summoned
709. He has the calling card.
Yes, but he needs an X-Borg
And then that's where 709 will probably come in.
Right, yes. Exactly.
Yes.
Okay, so that was the recap. Yeah. Let's spend our time in Nepenthe, which is where most of this episode...
I do think the killing of Hugh was unnecessary. I'm really kind of bummed out they killed Hugh.
Yeah, hey, all of these flashback characters are temporary. They're just service.
That's real disappointing.
Hey, man, all I want is a show about Riker's cabin. Like that's,
and making pizza.
Dude, the sentry, like, security system he has. Well, the fact that we got a shields up.
Yeah, that was, he turned on the Riker mode.
Yeah.
Immediately. That was falling right back into character.
Loved it.
That was great.
The two best scenes on Nepenthe for me were, there's a moment of Riker and Picard, like essentially Riker's making pizza in an outdoor oven. That scene was built for Joey Famelli, I think. and Riker does an analysis of where they are based off of the limited information, and you see their bond and friendship return. And it's the heart of the series in the sense of characters aren't stupid. Like, they figure out what's going on, and he completely dissects what's going on. I thought that was a wonderful scene of them coming together, mm-hmm, and turning the tables, where Riker is the one giving the fatherly advice to Picard.
as the one who's a parent.
Yeah. And you see that Riker is now much more mature than he was back then. Yeah. And then there's the scene at the dining table where Soji, who has been betrayed, acts like she has been betrayed. And she is unwilling to trust all of these new people who she has no relationship with. And even though Kestra, their daughter, managed to open her up, she's very unwilling to trust them.
She's guarded.
Until Picard kind of lets down his guard and kind of opens up. And it's the first time we've seen Picard, I think, truly vulnerable, and the Jean-Luc Picard we remember.
When do you see that? Because I remember him basically turning on his diplomatic mode.
Yeah, but that's the Jean-Luc Picard we remember.
Okay.
Like when he stops Will from like defending him, his record of who he is, yeah, and he goes like, here's what's actually happening. You see the leadership of Jean-Luc Picard, the real him,
yeah,
start to emerge back.
Hmm. There are a lot of Easter eggs in this episode. Kestra, the name of their daughter, is named after Deanna Troi's sister that she almost had, that was revealed in the TNG episode. Lashana Troi had a second daughter that wasn't born, also named Kestra. And then two things that bugged me in terms of technology. There's a piece of dialogue that the Commodore has in the flashback with Alison Pill's character, talking about how she'd sent over, after meeting with Picard, she sent over 300 gigabytes of data to his pad. Please. Throw out a petabyte or something. This is hundreds of years in the future. That's like 300 gigs is like the installation of Asgard's wrath. Come on. If you're going to be sending holographic data, you can work in orders of magnitude higher.
Now, is she Vulcan?
She's Vulcan.
Okay.
For sure.
So Romulans can't mind meld?
No.
Okay.
And she is, I don't know why she wears sunglasses. That was terrible.
Corny sunglasses.
Really, and they, the makeup on her was not great. The ears kind of stuck outward a little bit. Not great at all. Also,
can we get
Alison Pill, her character, when she's giving herself the self-induced coma,
right,
and she uses the replicator, that's like a Monoprice 3D printer.
It is. I mean, that's come up before.
It's like,
I'm okay. I was okay with that. But do you feel like a coma would deactivate the tracking device? That did not make sense.
I think she puked it out.
Oh, I don't think so.
No.
That was just foam. She puked before that. She puked the cake. Mm. Maybe she was getting sick because of the tracking device. She ate the track. She chewed it up.
Yeah.
It's like in her system.
Her character arc doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
So she goes from scientist to spy / assassin, completes her mission, has regret, and then is now good, but sacrifices herself for that. She's not earned any of those moments as a character arc. Everything is too fast with her. We got no, like, you know, conclusion from her killing her lover, Bruce Maddox.
Right. And I got to say, I've kind of flipped on her and the other woman who calls him JL.
Raffi.
Raffi. I like Raffi now. Like, I think she's fantastic. That I don't understand why she has to have this whole side plot with her son, other than to say maybe that's, you know, she's got reasons to be depressed. But I like her character.
I thought that whole side plot was super contrived.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we have a bunch of characters that we don't need on this show. But the core of what we saw, the Picard reuniting with, you know, trusted colleagues, earning the trust of Soji, that was good.
I felt like the whole performance between, you know, Troi and Riker and Picard was the best that they've done.
They were so comfortable with each other.
Yeah.
It felt really honest.
Yeah. Like
they were just happy to be there. The hugs were real.
But also Troi was, had the right of frame when she talked about her son, like you mentioned, like,
yeah,
it wasn't comfortable when she was talking about her son with Picard, like that she could still feel the grief in her voice. It was just honest.
Yeah. And when she was talking to Soji and trying to be the counselor to her, I thought it was all like some of the best performances I've seen from them as actors.
Hmm. Another Easter egg, apparently the wig that Marina Sirtis wore in that episode is the one she took off the set of Nemesis.
Oh, funny.
Mm. And she brought it back.
My one complaint about Nepenthe is like, it felt like a pause button for the show, that it doesn't really advance the story. It just does the character development. And so I still wish for an episode that does character development and advance the plot at the same time. This was really like a sidebar as they sort of move the plot forward. So hopefully they combine a little bit of this into next week's episode.
I feel like you're talking about pacing, and I feel like that's like, it hasn't earned the slow pace that it has. Like I liked that Star Trek had consolidated stories in a single episode, and even they had these like meta things that would continue from throughout the season.
Yeah.
And more so in the Star Trek's after Next Gen, but even in Next Gen to some degree, I wish that there was more, you know,
standalone.
Yeah. A little more standalone, but I guess it's not the day we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. Expect any of the other cast members to return?
Why not?
No. I mean, who's left?
Did LeVar Burton
say? Yeah, Geordi's the only one left.
Did he say he was in it or not?
I mean, Geordi, Worf, and Beverly Crusher are the ones who have not showed up yet.
I guess Crusher makes the most sense to me as a confidant, but now we're past that because we had the Riker Troy confidant episode. So what role does Crusher have to play? Well, I actually hope not. I hope we're just past that. We still have 7 of 9 in play. And they only have 3 episodes and they have to get to that planet and solve the mystery and all this kind of stuff. So let's forget about the TNG characters. Let's just get this done.
What resolve do you expect by the end of the season?
Well, I think there should be some mystery on who Soji really is that's revealed. Like right now we have her as Data's daughter that was created by Bruce Maddox. But there are these hints to like Borg Queen. We don't know what this whole destroyer
mythology. Her dream, not seeing the face of her father.
This activation, all of this kind of stuff. Like,
do you hope for a scene where Data, the character, gets to interact with Soji in some way?
There's going to have to be something.
Like
to
an AI?
Or, you know, like a video recording or something. Like, she gets to find out who she is through who he was.
Mm. Like Superman's Ice Fortress.
Yes.
What about if it's lore?
That would be too late. We're too late into the series for that type of
Are you guys 100% on the Commodore? Is she like on the side of good or bad?
She's bad.
I thought bad, but now like clearly she's either manipulated.
I think that this whole thing goes to where the Federation is right now and their keeper of secrets. And they have not been. It's more Section 51 than anything.
Yeah.
She's
not bad, but she doesn't think she's bad, but she's
right,
bad.
Right. And what the big Romulan secret is, right? The thing, why do they fear synthetics? Why do they hate synthetics? Why have they spent their, why do the Tal Shiar?
Isn't that what the mind meld was? Doesn't the Commodore know that?
Yes, exactly. So is there some, what is that?
There's more to that story, yeah.
And how that tied into the Mars attack.
I think we're pushing to the Commodore being like the lead into season 2. Because I think they're trying to set up this Section 31 spinoff.
What is Section 31?
It's like a secretive unit inside of the Federation that's like the CIA of the Federation that's off books.
It's the Federation's version of the Tal Shiar.
Yeah.
I really hope they don't rewrite Star Trek history to make it something like the Romulans created the Borg. Mm.
Yeah, that would be really unsatisfying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it has to end with sentience are good, right? They have to be wrong about that.
Synthetics are good.
Yeah. Yeah, not sentience.
Yes.
It might end with a cliffhanger of finding more synthetics.
A whole planet of synthetics. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But isn't that where she comes from?
And then it feels a little derivative of that whole Tron Legacy story.
The what?
You know, remember Tron Legacy?
Yeah.
And they're like Clue was trying to kill, what's her name and all her people, right? They're like the new life forms that are being, spontaneously created on the grid.
I do not remember that.
Oh my God.
Wow. I have to revisit Tron Legacy.
Yeah. But it's a classic trope of like, you know, these oppressed people because they're different and they represent a change in life or a way of life.
Hmm.
And so it could be a planet full of twins. Nothing but synthetic twins. They do come in twos. They come in pairs.
Oh, you don't mean all Sojis. You mean twins.
Twins. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good and evil. That's an idea.
None of these are good.
Only ideas. Three more episodes left. And next week, hopefully we'll be talking about.
And another season.
And another season. That's right. That's right. That does it for the podcast this week then. All right. Live long and prosper.
Anything coming up on Tested that you want to plug?
There is our last video from our visit to the backstage of Hamilton. Should check that out. It's about making microphones for stage performances. And I found it really interesting. Last week's episode was also super interesting. Interview with the sound engineer who does the live mixing of all the microphones and musical instruments during the performance.
And I'll say, if people have questions about coronavirus and I can refer you to people that you want to learn more, feel free to reach out and tell me how you're feeling about this. I actually don't think we have enough conversations about that. So feel free to hit me up or I'll be in the YouTube comments floating around.
All righty. We got an outro.
It's 4 years old. It's from Bruno Morthammers. It's called You Know What Else I Do?
Hi there. I didn't see you.
Tested.
You know what else I do when I'm laying in bed? Every 3 days.
Tested.
Wash your pillows.
Yeah.
Wash your pillow covers.
It's good advice.
Every 3 days. See you next time.